Hello and welcome to everyone who is listening to the Written to Melanin podcast, the place where you come to get your weekly dose of melanated creativity. I'm your host, CM Lockhart, an author of fantasy books featuring black girls who aren't all that nice and the owner of the Melanin Library, an online database of books written by black authors. And in this space, I share with you everything I've learned on my journey as a black and indie author. I'm glad you're here. So, welcome to a special bonus episode of the Written to Melanin podcast, you guys. Today, I am here with the author Multimind. She writes books that are fairly black, usually queer, and very much embedded in the world of sci-fi, fantasy, and horror. Her short fiction has previously appeared in Nightlife Podcast, and her works include Dreamer, Kinetics, and The Glass Man. Welcome to the podcast, Multimind.
Thank you.
Yeah. So let's kick this podcast episode off at the very beginning. Why don't you let our listeners know a little bit about your works? Because you sent me The Glass Man, but that is by far not your first work.
No, it is not. But pretty much, hi, everybody. I am Multimind. And pretty much, just what she said, I write works that are pretty black, usually queer, but always within the realms of sci-fi, fantasy, and horror. The works I have written are Kinetics, so far, Kinetics, Dreamer, The Glass Man, which will be coming out in September, and also I've done In Search of Amika, which is a novelette, and with Nightlight, it is Null Void, a short story. So I have quite a lot of works, but pretty much, I am well within the realms of dark fantasy and horror, so that's what I write, especially psychological horror, according to a lot of my reviewers.
Oh, I mean, I've seen your covers, and I was like, oh, this definitely has to go into that psychological realm.
Oh, yeah, I go straight into the deep. Apparently, The Glass Man is a little too deep and dark, but if that's your jam, that is perfectly great, because that's all I write. But definitely, yeah, I mean, my covers, they're done by Edge, who, she's my artist for everything. I go straight to her each and every time and stuff. I love everything she does, honestly.
No, I feel that because, you know, as someone who, you know, does my books myself as well, it's like, it's very nice to have someone in your corner to have your go-to where it's just like, okay, this is one thing that I do not have to like search the internet to figure out.
Yeah, I am so glad because I was like, I want a black artist. I preferably would like queer artists, but be black all the same. I saw her works on my Tumblr years ago, and I remember thinking every time I saw her works, like, oh, I'm going to put her on a list of artists I want to work with if I ever get my books out. And when my book started coming out, she was one of the people who I pretty much just knocked on the door of and was like, please put your art on my covers, like on my works, please, please, please. And everybody loves them, but I especially love them. She takes my terrible scribbles and turns it into bona fide art. And I love working with her because I don't have to worry about my characters being like light skinned or like whitened up. And I don't have to worry about like explaining how black faces work. Her works are already ethereal and it matches what I write. So it's just, everything just works. And I can just tell her like, oh yeah, this is what I want. I want my character nose to be wider. I want them darker and stuff. And I'm like so happy that it's just that already she'll have them already amazing. But I'm like, oh yeah, put on all these touches. Like, it's not that she'll make them narrow noses. It's just, it's like, yes, it's wide, but we can go wider. Like, random house.
I fully understand what you mean because I'm the same way with my artists where it's just like, I know that when I present my story to them, I'm like, hey, this is what I'm looking for. This is the idea. I know they're going to come back and they're going to be like, yeah, so this is what I got. I don't have to explain that there needs to be like different shades of melanin on the cover.
Yeah,
the lips and the nose.
Yeah, I give my artist the work. I give Edge my book. I tell her to read it and go from there. My scribbles, the book, and go from there. And she does an amazing job each and every time. I really, really love it.
Same. I'm actually the same way with my cover artist for my current series, Wrath of the Gods. You know, We Are the Origin and We Are Dying Gods. Basically, I've gotten to the point where I love my cover artist because like we're also just like friends outside of our working relationship. And so I'll just be like, so here's the book. Please pick some scenes that you think would be great. Literally for We Are Dying Gods, I was just like, it needs to be green, it needs to be dark, but like have at it.
And I'm the same. with my work, but also for me, I'll have like this terrible scribble and stuff, and I have to translate some of my scribbles because I will write it in like Chinese as a shorthand because I never learned shorthand in school, so I just use Chinese instead. And it's just
that
like,
wait a second, pause. We are not going to just casually gloss over the fact that you write Chinese.
I'm like multilingual. I can speak and understand 5 or more languages. I just stopped counting at 5, but that's what.
Okay, polyglot. You better come through.
I just understand what I understand and I don't what I don't.
Fair. I just wasn't expecting you to be like, oh yeah, by the way, when I'm trying in a rush, I just break out the Mandarin. Like, wait a second.
I nearly got in trouble in school multiple times for that because, yeah, going to white universities. But definitely, yeah, because we're sitting here thinking like, is she like on task? I write Chinese as my shorthand because it works and stuff. I know Korean, I know French, I know English, but Chinese is like, okay, quick, boom. But definitely, or it'll like be my Korean, my second go-to. But definitely, yeah, that's what I'll just do when I give it to her. She's like, Olivia, please, 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 multi, please. And I'm going, oh, right, that's right.
Like, please put this in English. That'd be great.
Yeah. And so that's the only part I have to translate because otherwise she'll just sit here and go, oh, wow, I want to understand what you're going with, but I don't understand anything because it'll be a terrible jumble. I'm not paying attention to grammar rules or anything. I'm just sitting here. It's like, this is a girl. This is supposed to be silver. This is supposed to be that. And so, yeah, so I understand. Even if she could understand all the languages, she would have still not understood what I was writing.
That's fair. But
and also Chinese shows up in my, actually it shows the fact that I'm a polyglot shows up in my work. The Glass Man shows bits of Spanish, Dreamer shows bits of Chinese, Kinetics has a little bit of Tagalog, which is a Pinay language, a language from the Philippines. So eventually I may just have a book that's pure English. I think my next book might be the Harley Quinn, but yeah, I speak multiple languages. We live in the United States, deal with it.
Honestly, I think it's really cool. So speaking of the Glass Man, I have the description up here that's on your website, and it says that, first of all, if you're listening to this, it comes out September 23rd, so go ahead and get your coins together so you can pre-order it, or you can go ahead and buy a copy when it releases, just throwing that out there. And the summary for it reads, Mars, the lead vocalist of rock band Illumination Rising, is learning how to live with his new self. Living in the aftermath of a devastating accident, Mars gained a new ability. He can control and create glass. That's not all that is new about Mars. His bandmates and family worry about how the changes affect him and fear it will only get worse. Mars isn't a monster, but he isn't so sure himself. So, that, like I said, coming out September 23rd, dark fantasy. I'm going to go ahead and probably throw in psychological dark fantasy based off of what you said earlier.
Yeah, I think like, they said the long term is like psychological dark fantasy. Dark urban fantasy, and I'm like, okay.
So what inspired you to not just create the Glass Man, but like start creating your books in the first place? Because you know, as writers, we all have an origin story, right?
So, I always wanted to write when I was 10. I wanted to be a writer. And that's pretty much what really kicked it off. I always liked making stories. I always liked writing stories. I still have my journal from when I was like 10 years old. And stuff like I just like it a lot. I like creating stuff. But definitely the idea for the Glass Man came when I was 15. And pretty much I explained this one on my blog, but pretty much the long story short is it originally started as a band fanfic of my favorite band. And I was like, because I mean, I didn't know it was a fanfic. I had no idea because they weren't. It was just, I didn't really know that's what I was making, but it was. But definitely, I just sat here and I just was like, oh wow, this like, I just am always drawn to the gothic and the macabre. So I just was like, oh, this is a great idea and stuff. And I remember my favorite band, POD, I first learned about them through a music video called Sleeping Awake. The music video Sleeping Awake is what put the idea in my head for the Glass Man. That and also just seeing the band themselves. They're a BIPOC band. Nobody in the band is white. They're a sound mixture of like Chicano and Black. But definitely, it's just it all that ruminated in my head. And I pretty much like years later, when I turned 30, like I just was like, oh, I really, really, really want to like put my books out and put much more earnest into that. And I was like, oh, I gotta complete this story. I really do, because the storyline just stayed with me throughout all that time. And so I did. And that's what I wrote. But also the weird part for me is that this was supposed to be a ID fan fictionalized it to hell and back, because I was like, oh, I really love the story and stuff, but I want to make it not fan fiction because I'm older now. But definitely, the part that makes me like laugh and chuckle is that the band that it's based off of, in that 15 plus years I eventually became friends with.
Oh wow, that's so cool.
Yeah, until I was sitting here saying, oh wow, this is not like a My Little Pony story. Like, here, it took me actually, and I knew them, like, I knew them for about 10 years and stuff. I think, like, yeah, it's been about 11 years that I've been friends with them. And I'm just sitting here, and Mars is based off of the lead vocalist, Sunny Sandoval. And which I, for those 10 years, would sit here and stare at him and just be like, how do I tell you that I have a book that I have a character that's inspired by you? But he's like, really messed up.
See, those are the kind of conversations that you just kind of casually leave off, and you're just like, oh yeah, I read a book. And then when they start seeing similarities, it's like, oh wow, that's totally crazy.
I just was like, that's exactly how I wasn't going to say anything, but of course I become friends with them, and the universe works in weird ways. I didn't want them to find out after the book came out. And you know, they just, and somebody like Head from Korn sits here and says, like, hey man, like, I've been looking at this book, and it's like, the dude's kind of similar to you, like, in a lot of ways. And then I get a text message that I don't want to see. But I I tried telling him, but I was like all gasping and wheezy and terrible about it, that he just like was just, I think he just mentally checked out, because he was like, oh, she's just being awkward again. And when I tried again with email the day before my birthday last year, and it's just that I sent him this long rambly email, and 3 days later he was like, I just got this, what's going on, is everything okay? And I just, it took me forever to just be like, I have a book and this is what it is. And he's like, oh, I'm fine with it, it's fiction. And I just was like, okay, that's great, you're responding way different from what I have in my head for the past 10 years plus. So he's fine with it, as far as I know.
Well, that's really cool. I love that the idea that you had when you were younger stayed with you to the point where, like, in your adulthood, you're like, no, I'm going to see this through. Because I know for me, there were definitely some stories like that where it's just like, okay, before I can do anything else, I have to, like, get this story out of my system at the very least. But definitely out into the universe. That's why with Keeping Promises, whenever people are like, oh, you have another book out, I'm like, yes, I do, but also understand that that book came from a place of like 16, 17 year old Chelsea, who was just wondering, like, what if? And then when I got serious about my writing, I literally could not leave it unfinished. I could not leave it where it was at. So I had to write that story to be able to get to where I was writing what I actually wanted to write. So when you were like, oh yeah, I wrote this when I was like 15. Yep. Fully understand that.
For me, I have a lot of works, Dreamers that way as well, so is Kinetics. So those three works are all what I call, for me, legacy stories. And where, meaning that they've been in my head for like 15 to 20 years. So it's like, those stories have got to go out first. The Harley Quinn, which is coming out to the Glass Man, is also another legacy story. It's been around for a long time. So it's like, it's got to go out. It's got to come out. And I'm very happy I'm glad to have them out, because it makes me so glad. It makes me so happy that, one, they're out my head. Two, it's like, they're, you know, I can share them with others. I mean, yeah, the Glass Man, I still sit here and look at all my rock friends and go, oh, because I'm not surprised. I will not be surprised once it comes out that they're going to start joking, like, oh, every time I'm backstage with them, like, so you're just here to get more content for your next book. But definitely
the shade.
Yes, they will definitely shade. The guitars will most likely shade me the most. But anytime anything remotely dumb happens, he'll probably be sitting here and say, so is that going into your next book? But definitely
sometimes it's like that.
But definitely for me, it's like I'm so glad in that I am able to write all these different stories, because when I write I just vomit stories. And it's really because I write longhand. I actually write with a fountain pen. And I stitch my own journals because I'm a bookbinder. And definitely, yeah, it's like I crank out stories. Like I think the last long work I did, in a week, I did 60,000 words. So in 7 days, I wrote 60,000 words. So that was like 231 pages or 261 pages. But it's
that's
big,
impressive.
Yeah, it's a big honker of a book. And I just did that in a week. Which that's kind of how I am when I write. I just write in one big chunk and then that's it. So that's why I write with a fountain pen, because it's the only pen I can use that can withstand like the demands of that.
That's fair, because I was actually going to ask you that, like what your process is, because when you were like, you know, you wrote 60,000 words in a week, that's really impressive, because I know like people do NaNoWriMo almost every year and they're just trying to get to like 40,000 words in 30 days. So for you to be like, oh yeah, casually did that in like 3 days.
Yeah, my writing group's totally not a fan. They're just sitting here and it's like, okay. And they're like, oh yeah, it's like NaNoWriMo's coming through, like, or for Malty's case, that 3 weeks is doing nothing, huh?
I mean, it's like that sometimes. So like, you said you vomit your stories out on the page. So I take it that you are a pantser, or are you a plotter and then you just sit down and bang it out?
I'm a bit of a combo. I'm mostly a plotter, but I will pants if something is good enough in my brain. And because for me, these stories, like for Glassman Dreamer, Kinetics, like these have been around in my head for like 15 years. So there's everything has been thought out and stuff. And I mean, I just sit with my music. I always listen to, at this point, Coheed and Cambria, because they're the best sci-fi conceptual art everything. Oh my god, like they need to have Nebulous, but definitely like them and Muse. And or I'll listen to these like albums back to back and just write everything. I do have what I call a master book, where it holds all the information about the characters, how the plot is supposed to go. You know, it has everything from the start to the finish about it. So I just refer to that and boom, I can just simply just put it out on a page without a second thought. And then I just type it up when my hand is dead. But that's pretty much what I do. I just simply do that. And because I write with fountain pens and I can write with different colors with fountain pens, I will sometimes designate a color for the ink, an ink for the work. Because I know with Dreamer and Glassman will eventually have a tie-in duology with each other called Glass and Dreams, which will be out in 2026. The fountain pen ink I used for that one was one of the ink. I used two different ink. Well, actually that one was three different inks. But one of them that was used is Monarca, which is, I wanted to use a Mexicano ink maker, a Chicano ink maker, because I was like, oh wow, this is going to include Chicano culture. It's going to be based in Chula Vista, so why? It sounds smart. And also the inks are beautiful from Monarca. And so I was like, oh, this is perfect. But definitely that's what I do. I just get my fountain pen ready. I just simply, and I use a quick fill. I use a Twisby 700 back R. I have the limited edition iris because it's pretty, it's see-through, it's colorful. I'm a queer person, why not? And it's pretty much, it's like, it's expensive. I mean, it's not Neil Gaiman pens expensive, but it's still a little pricey. But it's worth it. But definitely that's what I do. I just simply load up the pen and just keep writing and write endlessly and just block out a bunch of time. My phone is on Do Not Disturb and everything else in between. I am starting to learn to incorporate a thing called lunch and naps.
She said, I'm going to start taking breaks so that I can actually eat and rest. That's going to be great.
I'm learning that those are actually good ideas. They are remarkably, wow, they're just really great. Just eating in the middle of the day and like just going, oh, wow, I'm a little tired. I should probably nap a little bit.
No, like that's real. One of the things that I have learned talking to different authors over the course of like doing the podcast and like just interacting with people on the internet is that as writers, especially if we are like true introverted people, it's hard to remember to take care of ourselves. Like, oh, drink water. Oh, get up and stretch out of the chair. Oh, take a nap. Like, when's the last time that you sat down to read a book and it wasn't to analyze it or for learning purposes? Like, there needs to be a balance here. You know, joy.
For me, I am very particular about my foods when I am writing and stuff. It has to be foods that I can't do hand foods at all. Oh, it has to be foods that I can eat while writing, or just if I do take a break, I will eat it with like chopsticks and stuff. It has to be filling so I don't have to eat often and stuff. So I noticed for me, I'll just go with like kimchi fried rice and stuff with like tteokbokki and like eggs and stuff, because I'm like, okay, that's going to fill me up. And so I just keep writing and just keep going. So I can just basically, the name of the game is get it done. And it's just that me putting in lunch and also learning how to massage my hand is like really helpful, especially since for me, I actually have a special bandage I put on my pinky, because when I wrote my last work, which was 60,000 plus work, I wound up sanding all the skin off of my pinky, which was not great. And so I actually have a sports bandage for my pinky now, so that I can continue writing the way I do without sanding my skin off.
That's definitely a good idea. And if you guys are listening to this, you know, in the future, of course, let us know if listening to Multimind has made you decide to like give fountain pens a try. Sans the, you know, sanding your skin off.
That's got nothing to do with fountain pens. It's got everything to do with writing 60,000 words in 7 days. You know, fountain pens are great. I can talk about them amazingly. They're awesome. I personally love them. I use an ultra fine nib, and I love all the different like colors I can get. There's actually an ink I own that's called Writer's Blood. It literally looks like blood. And like, my goodness, there's so many varieties. I have some that looks like the ocean, some that looks like the sky when it's storming. It's so many different kinds. I strongly like fountain pens. And plus, because I write longhand, I throw pens away previously. And I was going, man, a turtle's going to choke on this. And I don't like that. And all I need is the rest of the pen works. I just needed to change out the ink. So for me, fountain pens is what is perfect. And plus, all I have to do is just get a bottle of ink, which is $9, and just fill it up again and again. It can take whatever I throw at it. I literally will not have to worry about like buying more pens or anything.
Okay, well, that is also a beautiful thing. So I'm definitely going to look into it after this, but that's neither here nor there at the moment. I wanted to ask, since you have written so many books and you have this process, how is writing your fourth book, which is The Glassman, different from how you wrote your other ones? Like, has it changed in your mind or your process?
Not
since
really.
This is not your first.
All I had to do was just try to avoid the cringe. And so I didn't listen to any POD music. I usually don't listen to POD's music when I write. They're my friends, so it's not a slight on them, because in case they hear this, hi guys. But definitely, it's just that it's like, I just don't want to sit here going, oh wow, all these memories I have. I like Coheed and Cambria because their music is just atmospheric. And also they're telling stories in their own music, like The Afterman and everything. So I just will sit here like, wow, it's like almost writing while listening to a movie. But not really. Like, I think because I'm very strict. One thing I will say, I'm very strict and disciplined about it. I keep my system the same. Even with the inks I have and stuff, like, I just go, okay, I'm writing a book. It's going to have this ink and it's going to just need this many, because I stitched the journals myself and stuff. So I already have a good idea of how long it should be. Like, okay, this feels like it's going to be a novella, so I'm going to make it a 300 pager or 180 pager. It's pretty much, I have all the control of making it, like the journal and stuff, the lining, everything. So when it's time for me to just write, that's all I do. So that The Glassman is no different from everybody else in that regard.
Gotcha. Okay. Okay. Love a system that stays consistent. I feel like a lot of authors could benefit from hearing that advice, because I know a lot of times it's one of those things where it's like, it's usually like, oh, the more you write, like, your system's going to change and it's going to be different. But something that I've learned is that there are always going to be elements of your writing that are going to remain the same from project to project. Like, that's the core of your process. And even if, like, some things change, like, you know, you change up the ink, or you might change up how long it is, or, you know, even how the idea comes to you. You know, some of, you said some of the stories have been in your mind for so long that you've completely, you know, played with them, twisted them around in your mind so you could just sit down and, like, vomit it out on the page. But you also said that you're, like, a combo planner and plotter. So it's just kind of like knowing your system and knowing that it can be flexible but also consistent is something that I feel like a lot of people, especially newer authors, can take with them and kind of, like, internalize, you know?
Definitely. I mean, for me, it's like, I have a disorder, so that's why my system's really strict. So that way, otherwise, I won't be able to finish the books, because I noticed growing up, I can start a book, I'll be in the middle of it, and I never finish it. So it's like, this system is so that I finish it. And also the fact that I stitch my own journal, I got that idea from the manga I used to read when I was younger, A Samurai Executioner. And that's what I saw what the author do. He had his book bound up, and I was sitting here thinking, like, wow, he gets to see his book in book form and stuff versus just a long sheet of paper. So that does help me with my brain and stuff, because it's like, oh, my book is already in book form. And plus, I mean, I have the same journal collecting problem everyone else does, where they'll have a pretty journal and it's too pretty for me to write in. So I make my own journals, which I call them skeleton journal, because it's the bare minimum. It's the paper, the string to keep it together, and a chipboard cover with it, the book's title stenciled on the front of it, which I show a couple times on Instagram, and I definitely show on my blog. That way it's like, it's very bare bones. It's nothing to influence me or anything. It's like, just, it's just the story, because all the flowery, like, and like movable, mutable stuff happens before the story gets even touches a page.
Yeah. I love that you have it so that it's just like for your, it's like a safe space for your brain, where it's just like, it's not too pretty to write in, but it's also in the format that you need it, so that you can still have that feel of like, oh, I'm still writing in a journal. Like, I've still got this. It's still collected.
Yeah.
Especially since you do it physical and not digital. So that makes perfect sense.
Yeah. But, when I, for me also, because, like, I don't like, one, computers fail. One of my computers actually blue screened on me and ate up my novel, and all I had left was the first chapter, and it not yummed up about, like, several, it was like the entire book. I was just, like, practically writing the end, and then my computer decided to just blue screen, and all I had was this first chapter, and that was, like, over 200 plus pages gone.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So that, you know, a journal, a handwritten journal, that doesn't blue screen.
True.
It will never lose my work.
My fear with physical journals is that I'm very forgetful. And so I'm the type of person who would take it with me somewhere. And then I'll never be like, I'll leave it somewhere, you know, or I'll misplace it.
For me, one, I always like, am always in the same place, so I never take my journals anywhere. No one ever gets to see them, and I have a drawer called the writing drawer, so it goes right back into the drawer right next to my fountain pen and stuff, especially because I don't take my fountain pen out because it's very pretty. It's also very expensive.
That's fair.
And so that's, it's fair. Like, it stays there, and plus for me, it's like, when I'm not ready to write or if I don't want to look at my writing, it's in a drawer that I can't even see it, so that way I don't have to think about it. But definitely for me, yeah, if I get ideas, I write on my phone because I have a Galaxy Note 9. So it allows me to, it has a stylus that allows me to write on the screen of the phone as if on a notepad. So it's like, aha, I have that solution. But yeah, I don't take the journal around. I just am on my bed and I write.
Love that. I have a couple more questions for you before we wrap this up. And mostly it's about, like, getting your work out there in the world because, you know, self-published indie authors, that's one of the things that we kind of all, I don't say dread, but also it's just like, this is not the fun part. The fun part is being able to write the story. So I know that you have had some of your work featured on the Nightlight podcast. Is it Nightlight or Nightlife?
Nightlight.
Nightlight. I had it right the first time. I knew it. Okay. you've had your work on the Nightlight podcast, but you also have your books available on your website, and obviously you're here on the podcast. So, like, how do you go about marketing your books? And then also, I want to talk to you about audiobooks, because I know, again, for self-published indie authors, that is something that for a lot of us is just kind of like, that's, I don't want to say out of reach, but like sometimes it can feel like, oh, that's, how do you go about getting an audiobook? I know how I did We Are the Origin, but I kind of wanted your take on it to see what your process was like for that. So how do you market your books? And then how did you get your audiobooks?
For me, I already have a background. When I have a long history in the music industry, and I was in the promotion crew. So it was my job to make, I was in POD's promotion crew. I was in Linkin Park's promotion crew. So it was my job to make sure that you knew their albums were out and that you liked them. And definitely, you know, so I picked up from that, like, for example, the giveaway that I have on the Storygraph right now for the Glassman actually replicates a band giveaway, what a band would do if they were coming out with a new album. So that means anybody who wins the giveaway will be getting a guitar pick, a clear page holder, a sticker, stuff that if it was a band in real life, they would have gotten that, you know, guitar picks, shirts, drumsticks, da-da-da-da-da. And also, so for me, it kind of comes a little on the easy side because I've been doing that since I was a teenager, but I had to do a lot of research. One thing is that I just read a lot because, I mean, I have my experience of promotion in the music industry, so I see what works with us. And I'm very much, I'm very meticulous. If I see that, oh, they're more likely to host Black works and things of that nature, then I'm more likely to go down that avenue versus trying to swim upstream and deal with a lot of nonsense that I don't want to deal with. I am not the type that if somebody says, oh, pay me bunches of money and I will make you popular, that doesn't work. It doesn't work in music, ain't gonna work in publishing. And so, yeah, if I have to pay for promotions, like right now I had to pay for Storygraph is legit and stuff. But if it's a random person, especially one you have never heard of, they don't have any like accolades under their names, nothing and stuff. They're just basically an English major with a dream. Don't bother giving them money. They don't know what they're talking about at all. And that's kind of how it is for me, because I'm able to avoid those pitfalls because working in promotions already in one creative industry, it's like you know what to do. So it's like, for me, I like the creativeness. Like for the giveaways, I do like the fact that it's like, oh, I can sign my books in glass with a glass pen. I like the fact that I can do fancy stuff, but I also am naturally creative in multimedias. So it works for me, but definitely just try to see what is accessible and go with the free ones first and stuff. Don't buy ads. Don't buy things of that nature. It looks like a good idea, but it's just a money suck. But also, if you only have like one or two books and stuff, it's going to take time before you see anybody. It's, you know, it takes time to build. And that's one thing I think a lot of folks want to rush out. And I think that's a kind of, sometimes it's a good thing that if you're not that well known, because if you make mistakes, half the world didn't see it.
True. And I think that's something that I personally just kind of believe. It's just like, I know as an author, like everyone wants to be like, I want my work out there. I want people to read it. But also keep in mind that, you know, there's probably a reason why the universe kind of funnels success, where it's just like you have to be doing what you're doing for a while. And not just with authoring, it's just like with any medium. You know, when you find a new, like you said, with music, like when you find a new artist, a new band, that song that you're hearing is usually 9 times out of 10 not the first song that they've ever created and put out to the world. You're finding them once they've had a couple songs out, and you're finding them when they're starting to get traction. For most people, obviously every musician, every artist has their I'll say their groundwork, their foundation, right?
I read from a book, but also Chester Bennington of Linkin Park said this one as well. Overnight success takes 15 years.
Yeah.
And I remember Chester saying that. He was like, yeah, this is an overnight success. That was a very, very long night.
Right. And it's like, even with authoring, it's like, you know, there's so much that goes into it that people don't see. They don't see the work. They don't see the research. They don't see the rewrites, the going back over it, the waking up in the middle of the night. Like, oh, that would be perfect. Let me write this down really quick. They don't see what goes into it. They see the final product. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's really important to remember that even as you're marketing, you know, you are building a business. That's something that I always tell people. So it's just like your first product may not be the product that takes off, but you know, if your second or third or fourth product takes off, guess what? People are going to go look and see what else you have done.
Definitely.
So it's really important to definitely put out your best work, but I think it's also important to have realistic expectations and not necessarily bank on that immediate gratification of, oh, I dropped a book and now I am a best-selling author making, you know, thousands of like six figures every month from my book sales.
It's like, for me, I just, because also it's like, I think as writers, we don't have to be on social media, because I've seen like when writers are on social media too long, the one comment they get the most is, aren't you supposed to be writing? Especially if they start saying really dumb stuff. But definitely it's really just that's a lucky thing, because if I don't post on Instagram or anything for a while, I don't have to worry about folks going like, well, what is she doing? I'm writing the next book. But definitely
I'm working.
Yeah, it's like, bro, an AI does not write my stuff. Just like what Nicki Minaj says, when Malty spits, it comes from Malty. But definitely it's just that, like, I'm writing my next book. But pretty much don't fork out money, like, because I notice a lot, there's no shortcuts. There are really no shortcuts. There are no shortcuts. Get a good cover. Please don't get like a crappy cover, because that sometimes will make people, amazing story, crappy cover, nobody wants it and stuff. And don't get an AI cover, because everyone can literally take your cover since that is considered public domain. But definitely it's just that, you know, take your time, even though I know it sucks, because I went through that too, but take your time and do your research, develop a groundwork. And I mean, you can submit to different magazines and stuff. I'm grateful that Nightlight picked me up, but also be realistic, look at like Black and Spec Fic that Fireside Fiction and Fire did, because you might not be getting into Uncanny and to Strange Horizons and to Asimov, not because you suck, but because they suck. Because, you know, they have their institutions to uphold and you want to write and be creative, two different railroads. But definitely, you know, just look at what you can. I really liked the Millennium Library because I would have loved it as a teenager, honestly, because I so badly wanted something like that. Because I remember when I was a teenager and I was like, well, I want to read a Black fantasy book. And they gave me Anansi Boys by Neil Gaiman. And I was sitting here like, wait, he wrote Coraline. No. He's white. I nearly destroyed a copy of Anansi Boys to prove my point. But definitely it's just because I was just so flummoxed and frustrated because I was like, statistically speaking, this has to exist. So I do appreciate having the Melanin Library, but basically know where you're getting in and where you're fitting in. The Glass Man just got mentioned in Locus in their forthcoming books. It's in teeny print, but it's in there in recently. So just look at who is accepting reviews, what their work is, and make sure your work can pretty much, your book can look like a traditionally published book. If it looks like macaroni is on a paper plate, they're going to see that and go, yeah, we don't want it. So it should be able to mimic it. I mean, for me, I did work at Random House, so I do have that experience. But definitely just take a traditionally published book off the shelf and see how they look, how their book formatting looks and so on and so forth, because it does have a look and a style.
I love that you brought that up, because that is definitely something that okay, so if you guys listen to the podcast or, you know, check out my YouTube channel, whatever, you interact with me on the internet, then you know that one of the things that I do is I offer mentoring services to other indie authors to basically make myself available to answer one-on-one direct questions and to kind of talk through how to go from, okay, I finished my book, to like how to get it out there in the world. But it's also like a lot of practical advice and a lot of things that people on the internet, generally speaking, aren't going to tell you, because a lot of advice on the internet, especially when it's free, is like, oh, just do this or just do that. You don't have to spend a lot of money. You don't have to do this. You don't have to do that. And I'm so glad that you have brought it up, because for me, I'm like, you don't have to spend money. But like you said, at the end of the day, the end goal is to have your book look as much like a traditionally published book as possible, because that is the standard for professionals. And that is the standard for this is a good book. That's the standard for this is what I want to spend my money on. And also, most people are not doing the research to find indie authors. That's unfortunate, but that's the reality that we currently live in. People are becoming more aware of it since 2020, I believe, and people realizing the disparity that is in publishing and are trying to do better, but that does not always translate into them actually putting, actually changing what they have.
They actually don't. Like, publishing has been like, they have publishing so white. It's been like 80% white since forever. Even when they go, oh, but we want to hire more diverse. No, not really. They're not that concerned. I worked at Random House. They're not that concerned.
And the thing is that I feel like I want indie authors to understand is just that, you know, when they're putting out these books, you want their books to look like theirs, because those are the books that people have already purchased. Those are the books that are on people's shelves, and you want to be able to blend in. It's not about like, oh, I want my book to look traditionally published. No, you want your book to have this air of, oh, if I buy this book, it's going to be something good, because no matter what you believe about it, right, wrong, left or right, people have intrinsic biases and they judge things based off of how they look and how they perceive it in first impressions. So you want your book to be that. And two of the things that I always recommend, like if you are going to spend money on anything for your book, which I recommend that you should, because honestly, you should not be afraid to put some skin in the game for your book. You should believe that your book is going to make that money back, but that's a whole other conversation. But I always say that you need a really good cover and you need a really good editor.
Yes,
those definitely. Two things are
my editor. I appreciate my editor, Jail. I found her on Tumblr and stuff. It took me a long time to find an editor. But I found her on Tumblr because she was like, oh, you know, English reading. And I was like, wow, she's like, her Tumblr was very interesting. And when I would read her writings, I was like, oh, this is very smart and idealistic and very nice. Great, great. And I remember when she was just sitting here, it's like, oh yeah. I remember she was like, oh, I'm Christian. I'm like, oh, that's nice. Like, my works aren't exactly for the Christian crowd, but she's like, I'm buying. I'm sitting here thinking, I will hire her. But definitely, it's just that, you know, grad kid, she background in translation. I gave her samples of my work, and I gave all the editors the same sample of my work. And she did a great job, because one editor I was sampling edited out the race of my characters. She was like, oh, they don't have to know that this character's black. That's an unnecessary knowledge. And I'm sitting here like, but you kept in the nail color of my character, even though that's even way less redundant. That's even way more redundant to the story. And she's like, oh yeah, well that's fine. And I'm just sitting here thinking, oh no. And this was a black editor. Sometimes it really is your own. Yeah, internalized racism.
That internalized hatred, that there's a reason why. I believe it was Zora Neale Hurston? I can't remember. It's one of the
classic. Not all your skin folk is your kin folk?
Yep, not all skin folk are kin folk. So some you have to be mindful, very, especially as a black author.
Yeah, I was very like not happy about that. So when I got my editor I have now, Jail, she did such an amazing job. She all she has to do is catch my typos. And that's another thing. You don't need developmental editors. You know your own story. You know, you don't need to have your story sound like J.K. Rowling. She already wrote her own, and also think about it for 15 seconds. You really want to sound like J.K. Rowling in 2023? And
That's fair.
Yeah.
That's
fair. In 1999, you had an argument. In 2023, you don't. But definitely sound like you. And think of it also in this way, because they're going to try to, like, when they say, oh, change the story, it's basically just whiten up the story. I kind of find this funny with AI as a sci-fi writer. I find it hilarious, because hearing all like the white writers complaining, because I'm like, well, you guys are so formulaic, even a computer can do it. That should probably tell you something.
Honestly, we're not going to get into that conversation, because that's a whole one. But for
but definitely this is. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, I definitely think that the gap in traditional publishing comes from the fact that there is very little tolerance for anything outside of the quote-unquote norm, especially within American society, where it's just like everything is fit into this box, but we don't care about your circle, your oval, your triangle, your polygon, whatever. You need to fit into this particular box that we have given you. Only the only people who will be successful are the ones who fit into this box. And that's kind of evident by the thing. What was her name? Allie Hazelwood. The fact that she wasn't really writing her own stories. Her editor was giving her ideas and telling her what to write. And then she was just putting the formula to it. So it's just like there was no, regardless of how you feel about it, left, right, wrong, whatever. I don't really have any opinions on it because I've never read Allie Hazelwood's work. I don't plan to read Allie Hazelwood's work. Whatever. If you like it, go for it. If you don't, have at it, whatever. It was just the fact that when that was happening, it was very clear to me that like, oh, this is only happening because this is not a Black woman. This is only happening because of the privilege that this woman has been afforded, and because every story publishing, traditional publishing, it was basically in that moment saying that we want every story to sound the same. We want essentially an assembly line of writers. We do not want creativity. We don't want innovation. We don't want things that are going to challenge it. We want people and stories that are going to fall into the line, that are going to fit into this neat little publishing promoting box that's going to be like, oh, we're going to do this, 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 and that. We want authors who are not going to challenge us. We want to just be able to make it a system that is as depersonalized as possible. And I feel like that's also another reason why Black authors in particular have a hard time with traditional publishing, especially when I'll say they live authentically in their Blackness, because the way that we write and tell stories, generally speaking, it does not fall into that nice, neat little formula.
Plus, traditional publishing is looking for Black literature. Like, I mean, how is Black literature is different from Indigenous literature, which is different from Asian literature, which is different from like European literature. It's all different. And plus, the editor at Bloomsbury, chances are stupidly good, they didn't take a Black lit course, so they're probably sitting here looking at your stuff and seeing all the references, and you could be referencing W.E.B. Du Bois, and they'll sit here and go, oh, I don't understand that. You could probably literally just copy W.E.B. Du Bois, it's early, and send it in, and they'll sit here and go, oh yeah, we don't get this, the souls of Black girls, what? But definitely, it's just like, it's just, you, for me, it annoyed and frustrated me, even when I'm like, wait, my works are good enough. Or I've even had like folks go, oh, your works remind me of Stephen King. And it's like, but you won't publish yet, though. It's just that, you know, it's like, yeah, because it's just, people might not get it. And when they say people, they mean white folks. And because, I mean, seems like BIPOC readers got it just fine. So when you have with publishing basically always kind of wanting to reflect itself and being very risk adverse because it's safe for the bottom line, it just tolls out the same thing over and over. Publishers Weekly talked about this back in the 90s, back in the late 80s. So it's not a new conversation. It may sound new, but I guarantee you it isn't.
It isn't. And I think for me, right, the whole thing with that is like, people won't get it. It's just like that for me, I'm like, when you say that, it's like, that is the attention. The only people who are not going to get it are people who are narrow-minded and bigoted. So it's just like, if that is who you're marketing to, then yeah, because the thing is, whenever I talk to Black authors and they talk about their stories, they talk about universal truths within their stories. They talk about being alive, especially within fantasy, right? It's about the adventure. It's about the growth. It's about the character. So you're telling me that you can't understand a main character trying to save her mother or get revenge for the death of her mother, trying to save a sibling. You're telling me that you can't understand magic. You're telling me that you can't understand anything in this story because the character is Black. But if you take that same story and you put a white protagonist in it, all of a sudden it's magnificent. All of a sudden it's top tier. All of a sudden it's something completely different when nothing has changed about the story.
Exactly.
Other than how you perceive the main character. What that tells me is that it has nothing to do about the writing. It has nothing to do about the story. It has everything to do with how you perceived it from your first impression. And that is about your internalized racism that you don't want to address. But I'm not going to get on my soapbox today.
Ideal reader is a Black person, is somebody who's not white, because it's like, I mean, basically me growing up, I didn't have a whole lot of people or writings that looked like me, and it seemed like the ones that did were really just droll and very like, it's a sufferer literature. And medicine stories are very important. Medicine stories are very important, but we can pump out way more than that. Like, and it's just that, you know, yes, there's room for Kindred, but there's also room for like the Black version of Harry Potter. There's also room for the Black version of Lord of the Rings. There's tons of room for it. Especially because
there's
Just that because also as for me, speaking as a Black kid, I don't need to see like a police brutality in like a magical world. It's like, wow, even here we get murdered. We don't need those stories. White folks do, yes, but I am like, just give me the fun stuff. Just give me the happy stuff, the happiness that I want that I see everywhere else. Wherein they have a white protagonist.
I am very much of the mindset that and this is going to be a controversial take, so take it how you will, but I don't read important books. I have not read The Hate U Give because I don't want to read about police brutality.
I mean, you already saw what happened to George Floyd, Rodney King, the list goes on and on and on and on and on. So you kind of know how it ends.
I live through it in real life, so for me, it doesn't need to be fictionalized in order for it to be important. It's like if The Hate U Give, and this is no shade to Angie Thomas, because from everyone that I know who has read that book, the book is objectively really good.
Oh yeah, however, it earned all the awards, and it deserves all the awards.
However, it's just like as a Black woman living in an American society, I did not need a fictionalized version of any of those events to understand or relate to it or make it real for me or to process it, because I lived through it in real time. And it's like, if that was your first, if reading The Hate U Give was the first moment that you realized that it was a problem, then the target audience wasn't anyone who looked like the characters included in the book dealing with the problem. And that is, in a nutshell, the problem, in my opinion, with American culture, because it lacks so much empathy for other people who do not look like you, to the point where you can just shut off their problems and shut off their experiences. And that is what makes everything so singular and narrow-minded and small, basically. But we're coming up on an hour, so I want to keep us moving, because I feel like that's a whole conversation that we could have within itself, especially the way I feel about it, hence why I do the Written to Melanin podcast, the Melanin Library, and everything that I do uplifting Black authors. But I did want to touch on audiobooks. We're going to have to keep that short. But I also wanted to say that, you know, when we were talking about developmental editors, I'm going to add a caveat to what you said. I don't think that everyone needs a developmental editor in the way that developmental editors are thought about. I don't think you need someone to change your story. You need someone who's going to help you enhance your story, because I feel like no matter how great of a writer you are, it's very helpful to have someone on the outside who can be like, okay, well, this character is inconsistent. This character kind of falls off the page. This character does yada yada yada. So like, know your story, but also I would say don't be afraid to like ask for help and to accept it. And I feel like that goes into like finding a really good editor who understands what it is that you're trying to do, who is not going to edit out your story, but understand what you're trying to do with your character.
For me, I'm more on the opposite end, but I'm more the please find my typos, do not do anything else, because the story is going to be a story. Because, I mean, Edgar Allan Poe didn't have a developmental editor, so that's how I see it. But that's also because I'm a Baltimorean, I can see his grave every day.
fair. So, audiobooks. Let's try to keep this concise, but, like, how did you go about creating your audiobooks? Because I know that's something that my listeners would definitely, for sure,
for me, I make it a point of what... For one, I keep it concise, because it's like, I want to be able to go back to the same person again and again and again and again and stuff. And it's hard to find narrators, honestly. I strongly recommend using databases such as African American Voice Actors Database, which I think is AAVADB.com, as well as the People of the Global Majority, PMGVO.com, I think. And both of those are what I kind of just use and to find my narrators, because I already know that since I write so many works that are Black female led, every work I've written so far, with the exception to The Glass Man, is Black female led. So I'm like, oh, I just need a Black female narrator. But I need one that can that's not scared of dealing with different languages and can handle different accents. My narrator for In Search of Amika, because In Search of Amika was it set in Atlanta. I needed somebody with an Atlantean and an ATL accent. For all my other works, such as Kinetics and Dreamer and stuff, I was like, okay, I just need someone who can handle all the different languages and accents. And Saraya Butler is my narrator for pretty much everybody, even for the Harlequin. I already told her, like, yep, you're getting slated. And because she's amazing with her different accents. She didn't know Chinese, but she had to speak some in Dreamer, and I did. So we worked together, and she managed to do as good of a job as she can for somebody who's knew zero Mandarin. So I am very, very glad and proud of that she was able to do that. This book, The Glass Man, is coming up, is a male-led story, so I need a male narrator, and I'm still looking for one. It's really tough because I'm also looking for either a Chicano or Afro-Chicano, preferably a queer Chicano or Afro-Chicano narrator that is preferably from San Diego, who can do the different accents and identities that are inside of it, and also say you have to speak a little bit of Spanish. So it's where I look, and I start with those two lists because I do not, I want, my books are diverse, so I want my narrators to be diverse. And because otherwise you just wind up with everybody. And man, a lot of folks have definitely chunked up the narrator like circles since the pandemic, because I guess they think it's just all you need is a mic and a book and you're done. No, you actually do need to know how to actually perform and, yeah, you know, do the book. But that's what I do. Also, I am learning, it's a learning experience for me. Like, I'm just learning how to work with SAG-AFTRA about like union contracts, because if you're getting a professional narrator, they're union, sometimes they're not. So I have to learn about the audiobook stuff that way. But honestly, when I do my books, is that I also have my own contract that I have them sign, so that way it protects them, it protects me, and they don't, and neither side feels awful about it. Because the last thing I want is to have a narrator that I like that just goes, yeah, I don't want to work with this person. But definitely it's just that you know, I just give them the book. I tell them like, hey, this is what the book is about. And before I send the contract, I'm more than happy to send over a copy of the book so they can read it and go, okay, this is, I don't mind doing, or going, oh, no, not for me. And also don't have folks signing NDAs. That's probably one of the easiest ways to convey that you are new and you don't know what you're doing. Mm-hmm. But definitely it's just that, like, once it's all this contract is signed, all said and done, and they're ready to go, what I do is I give them the book. I say, okay, we're going to do one chapter at a time. They do their chapter. I don't watch them. I let them do their own time. But also I talk to them first about how the character should sound and things of that nature. They do the chapter. I listen to it and I just say, okay, this is correct. Oh, these are good, but these are what you fell short, and this is what I want. Sometimes I'll send audio recordings of myself doing the scene in question so they know how to emote. And so that is kind of, it's hands-on. I'm very hands-on, but also I'm the one who's doing the audio engineering and stuff. I use Acoustica because I am not paying most of the month for any program. Acoustica is, you just buy the license once and you own it for good. So I use Acoustica and it's really, really great. But also I have a background in audio engineering. It's not a huge learning curve for folks. And also it's audiobooks, not a band's record, so it's easier. But definitely, you know, it's helpful. It's a work in progress, and you do have to be hands-on about it. But it works out well, because I want to make sure that it sounds just as good as a traditional, or if not better.
No, I fully understand. When I got the audiobook for We Are the Origin, it was very much the same process. I went through a studio called AB Book Services, and it's black owned production services. And I had, like you said, it was really important to me to have a black woman narrating it, because that is who my main character is. That is what it's about. That's who it's for. So I was just like, this is what's important to me. So I fully understand what you mean, like vetting it, but then also like going to the process and having a dialogue with your actor and being like, this is what I'm looking for.
Do auditions. Do not make my mistake and go, oh, wow, you sound great, and don't do auditions. Audition them.
you always need to do auditions, because someone who's great in one aspect may not be great in another. And some people are not super great, especially if you have like an ensemble cast. Sometimes you need to consider that you may need more than one person. Or if you have dual point of view, you might want more than one person narrating it. So you want people who can work together, but also if you're just doing one person, you definitely want someone who can kind of play all the roles. Essentially, you're looking for a one person show, and that is not easy to do.
No, it is not, but you keep them when you find them, trust me.
Absolutely. And last question, and then we're going to go ahead and sign out. What writing advice would you give to any new authors just starting out on their writing journey?
Just keep writing. Do not worry about the institutions of writing and stuff. Like, trust me, Locust has white folks on the cover. Nebula's got white folks. They give them awards like candy and stuff. It's not because you suck. It's because they suck. It's honestly, write the story you want to tell. It's your story. Read a lot, learn a lot, and absorb a lot. Learn skills and ideas that you never thought you would have an interest in, because it may show up in your story somehow. And never close yourself off, honestly. Just keep writing, really. And also, don't just eventually give up. Don't be one of those folks who for years and years, like, oh, I'm a writer, I wrote a story, but they never really do. Actually put something down, even if all it is just 5 words on a post-it note. That's a something, it's a start to something and stuff. Don't get caught up in lofty ideas. And if you're a writer of color, certainly don't get caught up in the institution of what is sci-fi, what is fantasy. They kind of don't know themselves. The sci-fi writers are freaking out over AI. So think about that for 15 seconds. It's really just write the best story that you can and read diversely. Read very diversely. Don't just read what everybody's doing, and don't do what everybody else is doing. This is a music industry thing, but nobody, if you're giving me a work that's like, oh, it's just like Neil Gaiman, the one thing is people think is good, well, why don't I just read Neil Gaiman? Don't be somebody else's advertisement board. You know, just write what's best with you.
I love that advice. Don't be someone else's advertisement board, because it's just like, the thing that I always want people to like internalize, especially when they talk to me, is just like, you have to do what is best for you and your journey. Because the thing is, what worked for Neil Gaiman worked for Neil Gaiman. What worked for, you know, N.K. Jemisin worked for N.K. Jemisin. But you cannot be someone else. You can only be you. So it's just like, living your truth, walk your path. And it's just like, you have to be confident that what you're doing is what you are supposed to be doing, and that you will get to where you need to go. But the minute you try to replicate being someone else, you have kind of, you've lost the plot, you've lost the purpose,
and you wind up getting like imposter syndrome. And not only that, but also given the stuff I've seen on the internet, trust me, there's somebody who's going to want to read your story.
There's always someone who is going to want to read your story. So that being said, we are going to go ahead and wrap this up. So Multimind, if you like to let the people know where they can find you and all that good stuff, this is your time to shine.
All right, you can find me at multimindpublishing.com, but you can also find me on Instagram and under Multimind Publishing, as well as on Spotable as Multiminds with a Z at the end. But definitely for everything you want, all Multimind is definitely multimindpublishing.com.
Awesome. So thank you so much for being on the podcast. And that is it for this episode, you guys. If you like to support this podcast, then please share it with someone you think may enjoy it. Join my Patreon at patreon.com/CM Lockhart, or grab a copy of my books, We Are the Origin and We Are Dying Gods, from my website, cmlockhart.com. If you'd like to support Multimind, then please purchase her books and follow her on social media. There are links in the show notes for everything. And thank you guys again for listening. So until next time, I hope all your books are full of melanin.